Park and Review Committee, and it started at nine, on the paper it says 9:30. Pretend we started at 9:30, but we're starting now. We have three major items on here, plus public comments and future meetings, but the chief's election criteria, and we'll begin with that one. I would like to just mention to you that we wanted to invite the new Oakland police chief to this meeting, but we were not able to pull it off such short notice. But he will, you know, we are going to invite him at a future meeting, since we're trying to coordinate with the city and on some activities and so forth. General Manager, Dorothy Dutter, you want to begin, and then Lane Kurtz. And this is about chief selection criteria.
Thank you, Director Ward Allen. And I'm passing down to the board members a work in progress. As I have discussed with you individually, we have selected a search firm to assist with the search for a new chief, Bob Murray. His firm is based in the Sacramento area. Bob is the firm specializes, it's a California-based firm. They specialize in law enforcement searches, not exclusively, but that is a significant portion of their practice. They also are fairly active in the city manager, city governance recruiting arena as well. Bob, who is the principal who will be leading this effort for us, has 24 years of experience in the search business. Prior to that, he worked in law enforcement. He was a police officer in Walnut Creek, and then ultimately, I believe, went on to serve as city manager of Walnut Creek. So he has Bay Area experience as well. We had hoped to have him at the meeting today to meet with the committee, and frankly, we had a schedule snafu, and he is out of town today and unable to be with us, but does have as part of his proposed work plan work with this committee and individual meetings with members of the committee to get your input as we go forward. What I've passed out is an initial, some initial thoughts on selection criteria, or maybe stated otherwise, what would be the characteristics of an ideal candidate for this position. And would welcome any initial thoughts you have today, or if you want to take this and provide feedback in another forum, that is whatever is most of most interest to the committee members. We do not yet have I don't have a proposal to put in front of you for the process. But I think, as we have talked before, key to an effective process will be not only involvement by this committee, but finding an effective and smart way to get input into the qualities, the criteria from the communities and interested communities that we serve, as well as the two police unions, both OA and MA. So this is getting us launched, and with that, let me open this to questions or comments, reactions from the committee members.
I have a question. Give me a little more information on Bob Murray. What is the name of his firm?
Elaine led the process, so why don't, Elaine, I just ask you to provide a little more detail
on him and his firm. His firm is Bob Murray and Associates. Dorothy did a very good job of summarizing the general sense of the firm. We contacted 11 different firms for this search. Three of them didn't end up applying, and there were three in the end that we thought all had pretty good qualifications to do this. I think one of the things that impressed the group of us in HR who were looking at this was that not only does Bob Murray have a strong law enforcement background, but so does the vice president of the firm, who also has a background in public safety. So their orientation towards law enforcement searches, and specifically police chief searches, as well as the individual skills and understanding of the principles, is very strongly oriented in this direction. So that, and the fact that they are a California firm, one of their most recent searches was the San Francisco chief of police, left us feeling that their local contacts in the police chief arena are very strong, and that their qualifications are really good in this very specialized area of search.
Let me just, something's pent up at me and I just want to get, okay, I think I'm glad to know that he had something to do with the San Francisco firm, but I'm really kind of very interested in process, and so when you guys, I guess you contacted 11 firms, you said, and then you came down to 3 firms. And who was on the committee?
It wasn't really a committee. Patrice McElroy on the HR staff and her staff did the outreach, collected the responses. They did a preliminary review, and I looked at their review, and we talked about it some more. And we looked at I think this committee looked at some criteria that we thought were significant in finding a search firm, and those are the ones that we took into consideration.
And did that include a lot of the criteria that we've been talking about in here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I have to just say, I guess what I'm kind of concerned about is on something as important as this, I personally, and maybe it's something I'm missing, but I personally would love to have known about the 11 firms, who the three that were selected before the one was selected. You know, just that's a missing part for me on a lot of what is being done, because then if all of a sudden Bob Murray comes forward to me and the committee, and I don't know Bob Murray. Mm-hmm. You know, he sounds impressive here. But I'm just saying that I would like to have, you know, had a little more input in that, because when the hits the fan, everybody hear me?
I'm hearing
I'm
you.
I'm real concerned about this. And this has bothered me very, very much. And I think these are the kind of things that we've been talking about. And, recently we had another situation. Process is what I'm very concerned about. Process and procedures, and having input and being knowledgeable of it, so that when somebody asks me, they say, "Well, Carol Ward Allen, did you have anything?" No. Did you know who bought? No. I don't like to say no all the time, and I go away looking like, I'm this robot sitting up here on a committee, and I'm just concerned about that. So I'm not feeling too well today anyway, so that's probably why you're hearing me being more vocal, because when I'm not well, I just go all the way out. Okay?
If I may, I certainly hear you, and it was, in fact, this process, we took a step back at the direction of the board when we initially came to the board to seek authority to engage a search firm to support us. You may recall that I didn't bring copies with me today because I wasn't anticipating this discussion, but we did develop criteria for selection of the search firm, and for the benefit of the committee and the public, let me just quickly summarize experience of relevant police executive search, experience and relationships in California, relevance and background and experience of the principals, hands-on experience in supporting the decision process, experience in obtaining and using stakeholder involvement, sensitivity to making decisions in the context of emotional events within the community, knowledge of modern police management, sensitivity to and demands of specialized police environment, particularly transportation, an emergency management commitment to assembling a diverse pool of candidates, and issues of special focus for BART, community credibility and relationships, training, leadership, succession planning, officer recruitment, up-to-date procedures, change management. And I had...
And one piece is left off, Dorothy, board members' input.
So this was the selection criteria for the search firm.
Well, but I'm just saying that board members' input is also very important to this.
And just to review the process, and I'm not trying to be argumentative, but to refresh our memory, because it's been...
Well, I know mine is gone, so there's no doubt.
It's been over.
And that is why I would like periodic updates, because my mind is going. And I want periodic updates so that I can have some little yellow tabs, because I have to do that now. I put on the door board meeting at 9 so that I know to go out to the board meeting rather than to go to the college or to go shopping. I just want to make sure that I know the process, and I just feel very strongly that board input, because we are each of the people up here, the ones that they're going to come, and I'd like to say, well, it was Radulovich's fault, not mine.
I'll second that.
Or, you know, one of those two down over there, they're troublemakers too. But my point is at least that we just had it. That's all, and I don't think that's asking too much, and I don't want to do the nice, you know, the nice stuff here where, you know, I said, well, I don't want to bring this up, but I have to bring it up because I want people to know that we are very concerned and we want the process clean, and I want the Tribune to get it right as well as him, and I want to make sure that people know we care, and that all this is a wonderful template, and I go along with the template, but I'm just saying I think we have to add on there that the board members have to be on top of it, because if I don't know that these three, you know, we were down to three from old, this is the first time I've heard that. I'd like to have known that in advance of this meeting. That's all I'm saying.
And again, just to review the process, I did send these criteria to each of the committee members and asked for your comment and feedback. I believe this was calendared on our last committee meeting, where we had a discussion of whether the committee wanted the search firm selection brought back to the committee or whether you were comfortable with my going forward.
Okay.
And the direction. And
here's the problem with me, because and I think everybody, every staff member in here knows this, and I think the board knows. Comcast has messed me up for 3 months. I can't hardly get to my, right now my fax is still not set up. My phone is they gave away my phone number, all right? And my internet just got straight this week, so I didn't get that message. So I'm just saying to you, I just want to know, that's all.
Maybe you could make some, along those lines, since I can't remember anything either. if you could make some copies of that so we could look at
them,
and yeah, just make sure.
Yeah. I'm not saying anybody isn't being efficient. I'm just trying to say, I just want to make sure we're on the same page, and that I just know, you know, I just feel like I need to know this, that's all. So I'm not beating anybody up. It's just, these are things that I just want to know about.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. in fairness to the process, I believe that one of our last meetings, we did achieve a consensus on the committee that the staff would go ahead and secure the search firm, and we would participate in the criteria for the selection of the chief, which is the first item on the agenda. So in fairness, I think we did have a conversation about this, and my recollection, and my memory is about as good as everybody else's, but my recollection is that we did achieve a consensus to allow staff to go ahead engage a search firm so that we can begin the process and not delay that portion of it, because every time we take an additional step, it delays the hiring of a chief, and we know that the current chief is going to be gone by the end of the year, and we want to get as close to that as possible. So I think the staff was just following direction as achieved by a consensus of this committee.
Well, I appreciate it, because I want to move forward and we need to move fast. I just still would have liked to know. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm concerned about process too, but I just want to know when. When are we going to get started? When are we going to start looking for actually getting a body here? Meaning, I know we have the criteria here. We have Bob Murray hired. We're ready to go. So can we ramp it up and start moving?
I think we definitely can. He was here yesterday, had a conversation with Dorothy. I know he understands the urgency of moving forward. So we don't yet have a timetable, and I know that's something that this committee is going to want to know, is what are the steps and what is the timetable, but I think we should. When does this committee meet again?
That's the last item on the agenda.
Well, I think in a fairly short order, we should perhaps by your next meeting, I don't know how often you meet, we should have something to show you along that line, but I wouldn't say now what the timetable is. Does that make sense?
We've also made some promises to people who come to those subcommittee meetings that we would keep them thoroughly informed on mm-hmm. what the process was, how we were moving it along, and more importantly, as we get closer to that selection, that they'd be able to kind of see what we're doing.
Sure.
So,
okay. Any other questions?
If you're ready, I'd actually like to talk about these criteria.
Okay, thank
yeah.
you.
If we're moving on to that. One is the process, and I agree with Director Sweet. You know, we want to be pretty inclusive in terms of who, you know, and for me, it was more about, well, what kind of chief are we looking for than what kind of firm are we looking for? Because the idea of what kind of chief are we looking for should drive the firm experience that you're seeking. So I'm glad we have both of these things. I kind of wish we'd spent more time with the selection criteria for the chief than for the firm early on. But here we are. So I guess one question for you, and I want you to answer, I'll make a comment first. I would say to these criteria, I think a background, I'm saying community policing is important, especially since we got so much feedback from the survey, the passenger survey in the Noble report that, you know, concern about police visibility, you know, police on trains and stations, you know, that is a concern, and that by our own metrics, we've done poorly with that. So that idea of community policing, and Bart's pretty well set up to do community policing, but so somehow that is part of this new chief's background and competence is something that I'd like added to the criteria. But I'd also like to hear about the ideas that staff have or the committee have in terms of, well, how do we get these criteria out to people? How do we get them up so any member of the public can comment on it and finalize it, both, you know, in the interest of timeliness, and I'm sensitive to that, but also in the interest of, you know, these are really important, you know, this is kind of, we're talking about who we want to hire as the next chief, and I want to give folks out there a chance to opine on that. So how are we going to do that?
That was certainly one of the pieces of experience of the firm that I was looking at in terms of getting some help and what's been effective, what hasn't. Elaine said, I met briefly with Mr. Murray yesterday. We scratched the surface, frankly, and have scheduled a follow-up conversation for more detail on that process. But he suggested a combination of techniques that they have used in the past. That include individual meetings and outreach to key community leaders and members, as well as I think some of the tools that we have some good successful experience with at BART in terms of getting community public input, whether that's posting it on the web, whether we set up a special page on the keyed off the homepage, yeah. But I think the web is a good tool that we have gotten some good customer feedback on, and I'm sure there are more techniques. This meeting being one of them, sure. I think.
Well, maybe, and I'm fine with you working with Mr. Murray. It sounds like he's got some good experience here, but ultimately this is about Bart's relationship to the community, right. and that's not something we can kind of contract out because that guy's gone at some point. And we're still here. So maybe if we could sort of you know, the criteria is one thing, but then sort of an outreach plan and a timeline. So, you know, we're going to conduct meetings for the next, you know, 2 weeks, and this will be on the web, and we're taking comments for the next week and a half or whatever it is. So it's really transparent what, you know, how we're going to get feedback and from whom. And also, if anyone wants to talk to us about this, you know, give them, hey, if you feel like, you know, you're a community stakeholder and want to have your say on this, discuss these criteria, let us know, we'll meet with you. So so some kind of plan would be great, and, you know, outline is good, because people might have comments on the outreach plan as well in terms of what we've missed. But to putting that out there so everyone knows what to expect, I think would be really good at this point, and get us, and hopefully get us to a set of criteria that we're all really happy with and satisfied.
Why don't we go down the room? Why don't we start with you, Director Keller, and then Director Sweet, on the beginning of your input.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just a couple of thoughts on item two, bringing about change. I think we've talked about cultural change, so somewhere in there, I don't know how we would wordsmith it, but include the word culture as part of the change that we're looking for. In item number six, although it's certainly alluded to, certainly I'd like to know the chief, the potential, the next chief's background in training and using training as a change agent in a department. And the study, the Noble study, talked about the morale in the police department, so I'd like to add potentially add a 13th about background experience in improving morale in a department that's undergone a dramatic event and continues to have some difficulties at the present time. So the rest of it looks pretty good, but I think we have talked about training and the culture in the department as issues that we're interested in looking at change in. And certainly the Noble report brought out the issue for me of the morale, the current morale in the police department.
Actually, I'm okay with the criteria as they've been set out, and I appreciate the changes that you brought in, because for number two, I just assumed it was a cultural change, but you don't want to assume anything when you're doing this, so thanks for bringing that out. But aside from that, this is a good start point for trying to find someone.
I agree. I first of all, I want to thank Dorothy and Elaine Kurtz for you know, having this available as a good start point. I would also, just in my looking at it, I would like to add good communication and media skills as you know, kind of a criteria. So when if something happened, that person can immediately go on before the television cameras or something.
And Director Warren, mm-hmm. we've tried to call that out in items 7 and 8. Mm-hmm. This is for the search firm. Number 7 mm-hmm. and 8. And if you don't think that mm-hmm. gets at it, mm-hmm.
okay.
But I think those, okay. I couldn't agree with you more. Those are key
capabilities
that.
Okay. Did you want to add, or anybody else? You're looking very stunning in your new uniform.
Thank you.
Okay.
The one question, I have not proposed it on this initial draft as a selection criteria, but I think it's something certainly that I am thinking about and would appreciate board and other feedback. We've not proposed that prior experience in transit policing is a requirement. It may be a additional positive in looking at candidates, but you know, there are a lot of discussion in the profession that transit policing mm-hmm. is a different is a somewhat different policing activity than just law enforcement in a city or a metropolitan community. I'm not convinced that it has to be a pass-fail requirement, but I think it is on the positive side of the considerations, but I'd be interested in any thoughts from the committee.
However, I've had some people ask me, they said, well, you know, if a person wanted to apply,
did they have to have the transit background? But the other question is, why would you want to work for a transit rather than, you know, a city police or department or county or that type? I think to ask the question is important, you know, because sometimes they look at transit as being different, you know, and if you can, and in asking the question, you would be able to see, but maybe if they have some preconceived notions or prejudices towards the transit agency.
You know, the bulletin announcements often say transit experience, transit police experience desirable but not mandatory.
Right.
I don't think you want to restrict your selection choice because of a background history that doesn't include transit, because there's plenty of people available with these skills and haven't worked in transit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes it a very small pool, I think.
That was my concern, that it was too restrictive. And
right. And also some of the other things we want, like experience working with civilian review. You know, it's going to be hard to find people who've done transit and civilian review. So it might actually start pushing out other criteria that are important to us. So I think what I think everyone else is saying here, which is, if you find somebody who meets these criteria and has transit experience, well, they're going to rise to the top over somebody who had transit experience. But I think if you put out there too strongly, okay, we want transit experience, some folks who would be great potential candidates, you know, may feel like, you know, well, I don't have a shot at this. So I would say put on there that it's desirable, but certainly that we're looking for the best chief.
Do you have any comments?
No. Okay. Why don't we open it up for any public concerns? Yes.
Archbishop Lewis here. Good morning, everyone. I wanted to really emphasize the community feedback on that, is that it would be so beneficial if the chief has prior experience. Like, we did have a new chief of police in the city of Oakland. He has prior experience in running that type of city structure. It'll be hard pressed for us to bring him up to date real fast unless he has some experience in rapid transit. BART is what, seven, I don't know how old it is, but since 1972, it's about 35 years old. There has to be at least 5 to 15 people that have had enough experience in the BART system or within your ranks. Your ranks here are very well suited for promotion from within. So why do we have to really throw our gauntlet out when we have very qualified members that have gone through a horrendous incident along with us that can move right in, not interim, but chief? So we have a structure already, and we needed it yesterday from the community. So I'm saying, why go through that exhaustive search when we have our finest and brightest and best sitting right here before us?
Did they pay you?
No. I'm only saying it.
Shameless, Jesse.
I thought Jesse's back there just doing it. You can't see him.
I said, but I'm saying, for our community view, we want someone that knows us and don't have to get to learn us. Because we have 35, 40 years of experience and they've gone through the ranks. It's not as if they're brand new.
Okay.
You know, I'm saying, so what we have coming in January, we needed it yesterday, a chief that can command, that can deal with the training, that knows what we're talking about. And we don't have to broad brush and go, oh, we need someone from New York. No, we don't.
Okay.
I mean, the community is avid and very sincere in saying, yesterday, for our chief, so he already knows. So everyone that's sitting here in blue uniform knows the sensitivity of the city of Oakland and what we need to have done. So why waste exhaustive experience? Just for my thing, I may be promotion from within is all we do.
But you also are aware we serve. See, one of the other side of the coin is that someone's going to say, "Yeah, but you serve three counties." So you know we have to be cognizant of a regional thing as well.
Well, I understand.
Okay.
I said, but
I'm just throwing that out. I just want to.
Yeah. One of the things that, as one of the co-chief or the interim chief that's sitting, they're aware of all the counties, all the nine counties. I'm just saying for us, it'd be more expedient if we promote from within. That gears our moral back to the issue with the director of moral character. Oh, we're promoting from within, so we our merit get a boost. So that's, you know, okay. The community's looking at it that way. Okay.
Any other comments? Yes.
I just have to say that I completely disagree with your comment. Sorry about that. But I feel like the things that have been revealed in the Noble report and the Myers-Navé report have all pointed to a force that has promoted and condoned bad behavior. I think somebody from the outside needs to come in and really get a handle on things. Secondly, I just want to say that I'm skeptical of Dorothy Duggar's ability to be involved because she apparently hasn't seen fit to discipline Chief G or any of the officers involved. So I feel like we might just get more of the same, where something like the murder of Oscar Grant happens and the chief comes out and says, you know, everybody acted professionally, contrary to common sense, contrary to your $400,000 of reviews.
Okay. Any other comments? Yes.
Well, of course, I love what she said. But, I mean, I have to disagree with him, though, too, because you can't take, I mean, I made this argument for before, you can't paint this police force with the same brush. Because we had, and I've been here for 35 years, so I can speak because I know it. You can't take an entire police force and paint them with a brush because you had 1/15th of a group of managers who did something that they probably shouldn't have done. But that's because they never gave the opportunity to the rest of the police force to do those things. So we do have very qualified people in this district that are qualified to get these promotions. We have people qualified to get these other executive manager promotions that we're bidding outside again, that we don't promote again, that we're paying two more search firms for. I think it's incumbent that this board start looking at why we are not promoting from within more often. Why are all these people coming from somewhere else? Because there are employees here who are qualified to do these jobs.
Okay. All right. Any other comments? Yes.
I mean, just on that, I think one of the strengths of the force we have now is that there's folks who've been career BART folks, and then we've had a lot of lateral transfers. It's a pretty diverse force, and so I like the idea of mixing it up. I think you want to have people who are career BART and know the territory, and we'll have some of those folks around. I'm a little concerned about the wave of retirements that we have, especially in the command ranks, and that there's going to be a loss of experience there. But it's also sometimes really good to bring people in from outside. They have experience, they have ideas that you know, can refresh what we've got here. And so I like the mix. And on this, I would say I'm not married to the idea that this has to be an internal candidate or an external candidate. I just want the best. And I certainly hope we'll look at any internal candidates who want to apply and, you know, not disqualify them. That's certainly not what I want to do. But what the district needs at this point may be somebody from outside. And I don't want to be closed to that either. So, and Sue, to your point, I mean, I think, you know, we spent a lot of time at the board thinking about this and, you know, why do we hire from outside a lot? And a lot of it's because we're not sort of cultivating people inside. To take the next job and, you know, not helping them figure out, okay, what's your career path here at BART? If you want to stay, how do we make sure that that you're qualified for the next job that you want, et cetera, et cetera? And we certainly need to do a better job of that. But even if we were doing a fantastic job of that, it's sometimes good to bring in experience from outside and keep it fresh.
Look how many of those people from out that you brought from inside are gone.
Yeah.
They all came, they took these big promotions, mm-hmm. and all the people that have been here for years and years and years didn't get them.
Yeah.
And all these people came and took what they wanted to take, and now they're gone. How many times have we filled management jobs because people came from the outside and never stayed? Mm-hmm. Lots of them.
That's
lots
true.
Lots and lots of them.
Just stayed for their 5 years
got
or less.
Yeah.
No, it's true. The higher you go in the organization, the more churn there is. But it doesn't mean that it's sometimes not the best idea. To get folks from outside, if we don't have it inside, and we're going to have I think a tough task just filling the management ranks at BART, both internally and externally, because it's a lot of people leaving all at once. So we need to be looking externally as well. It's just too many people retiring in a short period of time.
I have comments on that, but did you want to say something?
I was just going to say, and the last four department manager jobs that we filled have been internal candidates: our department manager of government community affairs, our department manager of IT, our executive manager of transit system compliance, and our department manager of, our program manager for the business advancement plan. We're all internal promotions. So I think we have a pretty good mix. I don't have the numbers with me, but we do look at that, and you're absolutely right, Director Radulovich, that the board's focus on this issue is one that's been clear and ongoing.
Like I said, I have some comments on that, but I want to go on and get the other director's views. Director Kellen?
You know, I retired as an executive manager in a law enforcement agency, and every position I ever competed for, there were external candidates. And I think the net result of that was I was successful in those promotions, but the net result of that was to make me a better executive manager, because I knew I was competing against external candidates. And I don't think anybody who's good has anything to fear, whether there's an external candidate or internal candidate. If they have a record and they understand these criteria and can articulate those, they should do just fine. And I don't know many people that I know of, particularly for executive positions, that fear competition. I mean, that's what's really, you want to go through that competitive process, because once at the end of the tunnel, you know you're the best of that group of people who went through. So I just don't think there's anything to fear, whether they're internal or external. If they're qualified and they can articulate and they understand the political environment here at BART, and they understand what the criteria, what we're looking for, and I think this committee and the entire board has definite ideas about what the next chief of police is going to look like, and whether they're an internal candidate or external candidate, if they don't meet those criteria, I don't believe they're going to get the job. He or she is going to get the job. So I just don't think there's anything to fear from external competition. In fact, my personal experience is every time that's happened, it's just made me a better candidate and ultimately a better manager.
Do you have a comment?
Yeah, so keep moving, because I'm going to be leaving in just about 15 minutes.
Okay, but you don't have a comment on that?
No, the best is what we want. Okay. I think that's already come out in everybody's comments.
I would just like to say that I'm a firm believer that sometimes we overlook local and internal for national. I personally would prefer, and my choice would be someone at least if they're external, they're from the area or are from a city that's very comparable. And I certainly believe that internal candidates should definitely apply and should be looked at very closely as a successor, because I think we need to do that more with internal, and then we need to have some kind of succession plan and a planning mechanism so that we can start training people from inside. If they aren't quite up to par, then let them know what they need to be doing so that they can become eligible. I really am a firm believer of trying to get that if we can.
So can we say that will be done?
No, we're saying that we're gonna kind of go. I think we need to talk about it some more, but what you brought up is very important to all of our thoughts on that, and will be considered. Did you want to?
Well, just to wrap this up, I think we have the criteria out there. I think we're going to get maybe an outreach plan or an outline of what the outreach plan looks like.
And then bring it back.
And I don't know that do we want to wait a minute?
We may need to have a meeting sooner rather than later,
okay.
A couple of weeks.
Okay.
So I'd like
okay.
to suggest
sure.
that. But
so something we can bring back and look at.
Yeah,
okay.
I think so. Okay. And let me move on, because I understand Director Sweet has to leave soon. But on the police visibility on the trains in the New Year's, and since both of you were involved in that one, we just spoke in.
If I could just briefly take a moment. I think this is the first time that members of the committee have seen Dan Hartwig in uniform in a couple of years, and maybe the first time that some members of the public have seen Dan. Just to introduce Dan and the assignment that I have asked him to take on a temporary basis, interim basis, as to return to the police department as acting commander in anticipation of Commander Gibson's upcoming retirement in December, and to give Maria a little bit of help in the command ranks. Dan served in the police department at BART for 25 years and reaching the rank of lieutenant, and then was the successful candidate for a new position we created to focus on security issues in the transit agency. So Dan has graciously agreed to return to the department on an acting basis, and I very much appreciate that. And he and Maria can, these two items are one to respond to the recommendations in the management audit, as well as the board's strong interest in seeing what things can we do quickly to increase visibility on the trains on an ongoing, and on the system, not just on the trains, in the stations, on the system on an ongoing basis. And then we wanted to particularly review with you our plans for New Year's Eve.
Okay, and welcome, Dan. And also, I want to just say that Commander Gibson will be missed. He has done a stellar job, and he's not here this morning, but I just wanted to let that be known as well.
He'll be back before
okay.
He retires.
Sure. Okay. All right. And I should call overseer down there. Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'll go with the accelerated version in the interest of time. So I want to give a quick overview of how we staff our uniformed operations right now. And right now, just to cover what we do, we're a 24/7 operation. We cover system-wide, that's 104 miles of trackway. It's four counties, 43 stations, and this includes other district facilities such as yards and lakeside. Officers generally work a 4-10 schedule, which means they work 10 hours a day, 4 days a week. Although we have 145 sworn officers, 26 of those officers are in special assignments, 5 are in training, and 7, we average about 7 officers on some type of leave, whether extended leave, whether it's FEMLA or industrial or some other type of extended leave. So our supervisory management staff make up the rest of the sworn personnel, which hovers around 183 right now. Our average staffing per day, these are the minimum requirements that we have in order to have full beat coverage, the way that we have designed our beats right now. So for day shift, it's 23 officers to cover 20 beats. 2 canine officers supplement the day shift officers. On swing shift, it's 23 officers to cover 20 beats. And again, they're supplemented by 2 canine officers. On graveyard, the beats are extended, and it's 9 officers to cover 8 beats. And that means that since the numbers don't match, that means some of the beats are doubled up and they're train beats. So they're doubled up on the train beat, or in downtown San Francisco on graveyard, they're doubled up. Staffing on Tuesdays and Thursdays right now with the current sign-up is higher to facilitate training. So we try to have training on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When we don't have training on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we use those days to try to saturate the system or do special enforcement details if we have a crime trend occurring at one of our facilities. The system is divided into 4 zones, and I'll just go over that pretty quickly here. Oakland, Richmond, Southern Alameda County to San Leandro, and then the San Francisco line. Officers assigned per shift. In Oakland, we average 5 per shift. In the Richmond-Concord line, that's one zone, we average 6, that's 3 per line. In the Southern Alameda County area, zone 3, we average 4 officers. In the San Francisco line, we average 8 officers. Again, we supplement those officers with the canine officers on both the morning shift and the evening shift. We average about 120 calls per day, so in a 24-hour period. Most calls on the trains that are reported on the trains, calls for service, are quality of life type violations. The more serious criminal activity occurs in parking lots and in the free areas of the stations. Our response time goals right now are 4 minutes for emergency calls and 8 minutes for non-emergency calls. Our challenge right now is to find a way to increase train visibility, station visibility of our officers with the current staffing. We don't want to impact customer safety. We don't want to impact officer safety, and we don't want to impact or cause more train delays. So we have to find a balance and be flexible to the dynamics of policing the system. So currently, what we do as far as officers assigned to train beats, it's two train beats in San Francisco that goes from 24th Street to Embarcadero, and they're two officer units. And then there's one train beat in Oakland. It's a double unit, and that one's for day shift. And on swing shift, we try to mirror that when we can. As far as visibility in stations and in trains, our current minimum requirements of the officers are two security checks of stations per officer per shift, and then two train inspections per officer per shift. So to give you an idea, because I said one of the things we don't want to impact patron safety, customer safety, officer safety, to give you an idea, in 08 we had 133 robberies, most of those occurring in parking lots or free areas of the stations. Auto theft, we had about 500. Burglaries, we had almost about 1,000. As far as documented calls for service, or events, we have 43,000 calls per service per year on average. That's the 120 average per day. Not all of those turn into written reports by the officers, because a lot of them are handled and there's no report written. But as far as when a report is written and or a citation is written, that's about 4,500 cases that are documented. Out of the 4,500 cases that are documented, 2,000 are for more serious crimes such as robberies, burglaries, auto theft, and about 2,500 are for the quality of life type violations. So almost quality of life violations are higher, obviously. If we had more officers on train, that number would probably go up. But it's a balance that we have to balance in trying to police the system and keeping as many people safe as possible. So as far as what we've looked at to do with our current staffing, and again, without making impacts on or what I mentioned previously, is trying to get officers during peak periods in areas where our riders who are in the system can see them, contact them, know that they're available. So our strategy to increase visibility in stations, this can happen tomorrow, with our current staffing, is during peak service hours, all patrol officers and sergeants will focus their patrol energies inside high-use stations such as entry gates, platforms, onboard trains, top or bottom of main stairways. The peak hours are identified in the morning commute and then in the afternoon commute. So roughly 7 in the morning to about 9 in the morning, and then maybe 4:15 to about 6:30 in the evening. In addition to that, regular patrol lieutenants, sergeants, and officers throughout the day will board and ride a minimum of 2 trains during their shift in their assigned beat. Right now, an assigned beat is usually 2 stations. We plan to put our special problems unit, these are the plainclothes officers that do special enforcement type activities, our administratively assigned officers and sergeants, we plan to put them on trains, high visibility on trains, 2 times per month for an hour during their shift. After the primary parking enforcement period, we're going to use our CSOs to, again, be visible on trains twice per week for an hour of their shift. And then we're also implementing a daily activity log. It's still in the draft format. And so that we can capture this new information that we're trying to change and how we increase visibility on trains and in stations. And again, that's in still draft format. We've worked with the OA, the Officers Association. We've met with the Officers Association, gotten input, shared suggestions, and they're fully on board as far as I know. Yeah. That's what they're telling me. And so this is we're working together to improve in this area, which we've always been low on. The long-term strategies, again, it's based on staffing availability, but to have dedicated train teams during the weekdays, day shift and swing shift. And then part of that would be to review our data and make adjustments based on what we're seeing in the data.
That's the quick version on the increased visibility. I don't know if you want us to just move right into new fee service or take questions.
Actually, I'd like to address something that you said. And you're coming up with this daily activity log so that you'll be able to monitor to ensure that all this stuff is happening that you want to see, right?
Yes.
So on this log, because again, the biggest complaint that we seem to be getting about police is the whole visibility question. Well, not the biggest, but a consistent complaint has been the visibility. So I just want to make sure that you understand that that's the part that I know as a director I'd be watching. But I also wanted to let you know something good that I saw happening. I mean, with the bridge closure, you did have increased presence. At least I saw more police officers in and around the San Francisco stations. And on Monday, when I took the train over here from Daly City, I saw probably the nicest police interaction I've ever seen in my life. And it was a police officer approaching a guy who had actually done something wrong. He didn't pay. And when the police officer went over to him, he just smiled and said, "You know why I'm stopping you, right?" And the guy goes, "No, I didn't do anything." He goes, "Yeah, you don't have a ticket." And he goes, "Oh, yeah." I mean, it was just the nicest exchange. It wasn't confrontational. It was really the way police officers should approach people. It's like, "I got to stop you and I'm going to ask you." But it was smiling. I mean, it wasn't confrontational. And it was just, as director, it was good for me to see something like this. Like, we don't beat up everybody. I don't mean that in a bad way, but it was really a good situation to see. It was
if I can make a comment, one of the other things that we've done that is not measurable necessarily, but we're telling our officers and we're telling our lieutenants we want to lead by the top down. Lead by example. So our lieutenants are, I'm pointing to Lieutenant Ledford there because I hear him on the radio all the time, but they're out there. They're checking trains, and what we're telling our officers is be noticed. Say hi to people. Mm-hmm. You know, make noise when you're walking through a train. It's not walk through a train with tunnel vision and only looking for, activity that, to give your, probable cause to detain someone. You're engaging customers and make it a two-way street. When you're walking through a train, have your radio volume up so they look up. Again, you want to make eye contact, say good morning, how's it going today? People don't expect that generally from us, and so we do want to change the way that we conduct business right now.
Well, I could see that that's starting to happen. I mean, like I said, it was the most cordial police interaction I had ever seen.
Yeah.
Well, one thought was, since you've got a lot of new eyes and ears on trains and in stations, figuring out some way that officers can, if they're getting feedback from customers, like, "Oh, this passageway is really poorly lit," or, "I always feel threatened here," or, "Fare evaders always jump over there," that that there's some kind of form or some kind of way that their notes, their feedback, et cetera, can kind of get into the system. Because I want to be having all those eyes and ears out there and turn that into change. So if our customers are noting something or the officers are noting something, we, oh, this, you know, lights are out here, whatever, that we can turn that into a change that's going to make our passengers safer. The other thought, and I'm not going to ask you how to do it now, but I know that, you know, Travis always, you know, gets flustered when we talk about the quarterly performance review and the visibility, and he's like, that's not a great metric, and so on. So what I hope you'll do is turn these into metrics so that every quarter we'll know, for example, okay, well, we had a goal of having, you know, 1,800 person hours, and we met that goal, or we didn't meet that goal, or we exceeded it. So that we know, like, from your own tracking, that'll show up in the quarterly performance report. I'm not saying let's get rid of the inspectors out there on stations and trains. I think that's, you know, it's good to have information from the outside, our people seeing you, but then also having your own internal measures of, yeah, we set this goal for ourselves, we're meeting it, we're exceeding it, we're not meeting it, what's going on. That's also really helpful for us to know that that you've done that. So I'd say let's turn those into a goal, and then hopefully in the next quarter we can track this and know how well you're doing, and then you can tell us, hey, this didn't work out for this, we need more resources, we need, you know, to change our strategy, whatever. So. But yeah, it's good to see all this, and I appreciate the effort at kind of an increased presence.
Absolutely.
Because I think it's important to people.
Thank you very much.
Jesse, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, just an answer to the question. Officers do that already.
Okay.
They write beat condition reports.
All right.
There's a lack of lighting in the stations, or there's some sort of safety hazard, even in the lots or anywhere. The problem that the officers are having is we don't see the follow up coming from the bar and the maintenance.
Interesting.
That. That's coming from us.
So they're collected, is it the sergeants
write,
then that?
We write beat condition reports that are turned in to identify these problems, but we don't seem to see the follow-up.
I think how we can change a little bit, Jesse, is the fact that if we include the patrons to advise us of these things that the director brings up, and then we include those comments, and then we follow the pattern, what actually happens.
Correct.
Because there are situations where we have broken lights, we have dark areas, and we need to have a real document, a living document, where we can track that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, could we have a few documents where, you know, like the roll call for introductions, where you kind of see the date that the, you know, it was noted, and then you'll know what the follow-up was, too, so that the department that's in charge of fixing that would have to say, yeah, we fixed it, we didn't fix it, it's still pending, whatever it is. So it would be good to know maybe how that works internally. So how the police collect it all, put it all out there, and then how the departments who actually have to fix those things, how responsive are they, what's their follow-up, you know, can anybody access that, and so on. So maybe you could let us know how that works. I'm not at this moment, of course, but just think about a system so that we're using those eyes and ears as effectively as we can in solving customer problems.
Maria, could you, again, not at this moment, but at some future time, give us a breakdown of the 26 special assignment officers? What are they assigned to? I'm just interested in what their current assignments are. And just to be parochial, there's no train beat in Contra Costa County, just in San Francisco and Oakland.
Correct.
And
again, the logic of the train beats.
The chair is feeling no.
The train beat is where the officers patrol exclusively on the train. There is no vehicle assigned. They're relying on the train for their transportation to respond to calls for service. And so we have historically focused those in the downtown areas where there is more frequent service. In San Francisco, there's the alternative of Muni. If an officer needs to respond outside of the his or her current location in Oakland, we have a richer and more frequent service out in the out on the other lines. We're at 15-minute or next service 20-minute headways, which, if the train is the only form of transportation, challenges our ability to meet response time. Or alternatively, you know, when the reliance is on the adjoining beat officer to cover or respond if an officer has been taken off the beat to respond to transport a detainee or to respond somewhere off the system, again, that's the challenge that we face. And I think the plan that Commander White and Hardwick have developed for increasing visibility is even in those in every beat, that we are requiring officers and sergeants to spend some time on the train. It's just not an exclusive, park their car at a station, ride the train, so it'll hopefully increase visibility on the trains, but it's not an exclusive beat at this point.
No, that makes sense. I get that. Is the San Francisco line includes San Mateo, I take it?
Yes, it does, all the way to the airport in Millbrae.
But the train beats are 24th Street to Embarcadero, so.
I just spent a week in New York and was on the subway a lot, and the presence of the NYPD mm-hmm. and the Port Authority police in that system is incredible.
Yes.
Obviously, they get a lot of threats, and it makes a whole lot of sense why they're there. But in some stations, there are four officers, being dumb, I walked up to it. In one of the downtown stations, they had automatic weapons. I had never seen NYPD on routine patrol with M16s. It was like, so I walked up to one of the officers and I said, "Is there something going on?" He said, "Oh no, this is just routine." "Oh, okay, you walk around with M16s all the time." "Sure you do." But he obviously wasn't gonna say anything to me. But it is remarkable. It is remarkable how visible the NYPD and Port Authority police are on that system. And my sense is the public likes that a lot.
And if you live here, you know why.
Yeah, they like seeing those
if
cops.
If you lived in New York, you would understand.
I was the only one who flinched when I saw the uniformed officers with M16s. People just walk by like, that's just normal.
I believe that's a post-September 11th change in weaponry. The New York and the Port Authority also have been recipients of significant
lots of grants.
You can see
there's lots of money. They have a camera. NYPD has a camera on practically every telephone pole in downtown, in the main heart of, especially around Times Square. It is remarkable how many, and they're very visible. They have NYPD logos on it. They're not trying to hide anything. They look like deterrents. But I've said this for a number of years in Contra Costa and all the counties. People feel comfortable when they see a uniformed officer on the train. It just puts them at ease. 99% of our riders are good, decent, hardworking people, and they just want to feel safe. And I'm glad we're going to have more visits. We don't need M16s, but not right now, but at some point.
Well, post 9/11, we had officers in special uniforms, and they carried their AR-15s, and we got too many complaints, and we stopped doing it.
I think out here it would be make people. But I didn't see anybody feeling uncomfortable back there. I was probably the only person that was thinking, what's going on here?
The question is, are you going to use an automatic weapon in a crowded train or a station? Right?
Well, you might get the you might get the bench.
And people ask me, could we really use, are police actually going to use them? And the answer I got was no.
Let me just remind you, we're at 11 o'clock now, but I wanted to mention that I noticed on here you have a long-term strategy to assign a dedicated train team on both day and shift swing. What is that? On both day and...
It should be swing shift.
Swing shift. That's what I thought it was me. All right. But anyway, my concern, I think that's great because I don't know why we haven't had that more. This just seems like a no-brainer. I like the daily log, too. The daily activity log seems like to me something we needed. But we need to move on, so
yes,
why don't we just go ahead and then we can come back to any of our questions and the New Year's Eve service plan, if we can move on that.
We shall do that. Thank you for... I will give you the short version. As Commander White has described what our normal deployment of officers is for a daily operation, you're well aware of. On New Year's Eve, we increased those numbers to the level of about 98 uniformed officers with 25 to 30 supervisors in uniforms as well. We understand it's a huge challenge on New Year's Eve. Our focus is on large crowds arriving to their destinations in a safe manner. We understand that the requirement for our level of tolerance needs to be increased on New Year's Eve. We want to encourage the public to ride our system. We want to encourage them to be safe and to respect our system and the other people that are in the system. And we'll do everything that we can do to make sure that occurs. The actual deployment of our officers is significantly different than a day-to-day operation because of the numbers that we have. We go to available officers, that I said earlier, around 95 uniforms, 28 supervisors. We have put a request out for mutual aid from allied agencies. At this point in time, San Francisco Sheriff's Department has offered 14 officers for the evening. We are awaiting a response from Alameda County Sheriff's Department as well. Our staffing and deployment of officers is based upon strategic deployment. We understand and we know the ultimate destination of the majority of our riders at night, and you'll see the majority of our officers in those locations. The difference this year, as opposed to last year, we will have teams of officers that are inclusive of four officers and one supervisor that prior to the main event, the midnight hour, will be riding trains on beat locations throughout the system. The closer we get to that meet in the midnight hour, we redeploy those officers to the areas that we are keenly aware of. We are prepared to respond to any station that requires a significant amount of police presence. We can do that through the trains as well as through mobile vehicles. The difference this year, last year, sergeants were mobile within the system, not necessarily in the stations. They would respond as called. This year, they will actually be with their teams in the systems. There will be more lieutenants on duty and available for the entire shift. This year, for the first time in I can't remember how long, I believe that we've actually had officers as well as command staff personnel cancel days off to be available New Year's Eve. Now, that being said, between now and New Year's Eve, there are going to be situations that are, people will call it sick. They'll miss work for whatever reason. Right now, we have the most officers available, to the best of my knowledge, that we've ever had. We also have detectives on duty rather than off duty that evening. We won't have to have a call out if we have a major crime scene. The ability that we have this year, any crime scene that we have, we will better manage. We believe we do an outstanding job in deployment of officers for crowd control purposes. We're pretty good at that. We want to do a better job at managing a specific scene if that indeed occurs. We have multiple recommendations from the Meyer-Navarre report. We continue and will continue to follow those recommendations, specifically regarding training. We remain focused at the task at hand. I think it's been said more than once here this afternoon. We are well aware that the culture needs to change within our department, and we believe that we have the ability to do so. The challenge has to do with the numbers of people that we deal with and how we respond and how we react within our district properties. We believe we do a good job. We're going to do a better job. We spoke about riding trains and being within the system. I think, Jesse, it was mentioned, we want to engage the public. We want to give them the opportunity that night when they're sitting down talking with their family, the perception of our police is positive. And we know that can be done. We will go out of our way to do that. New Year's Eve is a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge for the police department. It's a huge challenge for operations. Together, we will work to make sure it's a safe one.
And with that reference to operations, Paul is here to give you just a quick overview of the service that we are planning to operate on New Year's Eve.
Before we go to Paul, can I ask Dan just one quick question? How are you going to manage fatigue? I mean, you're going to bring in that many officers in, there are going to be a lot of people running around who are armed, who have not had a whole lot of sleep. Do you have a plan to manage fatigue?
Absolutely. Halloween night, not because we knew what was occurring with the bridge, but we had an opportunity to basically have a dry run. We had a lot of officers within the system that night. We put them on trains in teams with supervisors. The supervisors are extremely aware to remain hydrated, to eat, to get off your feet. Mm-hmm. they take those breaks. And what they do strategically is they do it prior to the activity that we know increases. We're a bit well aware of it. Matter of fact, we have some tactical team members that brought in actual
power bars, cliff bars,
somebody made special. They're well aware of that. Because what you don't realize if you haven't done it, walk through our trains or walk through our systems for 6 to 8 to 10 hours, it's extremely fatiguing. It's definitely addressed. We will be prepared.
Okay.
The other thing that we're doing is we're canceling days off. So an extra day shift officers that would work that day, we're moving them to swing shift hours. So, and they would have rest before they would have to come back to work.
Do you have an internal policy that limits the amount of hours that a uniformed officer can work before they're required to take a break?
Yes.
Is that 16?
It's 20. They can't work more than 20 hours. If they work more than 16 hours, they must take an 8-hour break before they come back.
So that's a double back. Their shifts are 10, so they can do a double.
They can do a double.
Then they have to take a break.
Yes.
On your durable time frame, you know, most of the time, the patron, myself, want to know what hours will the heightened visibility be available, like for, say, New Year's Eve. In the CHP department, they have from 12 such and such on this day through 12 such and such on this day, which is 36 to 48 hour shift. Are you planning on, just piggybacking on Director Keller's, are you planning on having a window that will be available, say, you know, December 31st through January 2nd? Is that the time for visibility time frame you're going to be in for the public's preview? Or is it going to be December 31st through 12 noon, January 1st? Is there a plan for that?
It's more like December 31st to January 1st when the actual event ends. And the difference we have because of our district and how we operate, we know when the event's over. But we'll extend officers. There aren't patrons left in the system without officers there. That visibility begins at 4 o'clock on mm-hmm. December 31st mm-hmm. and remains till at least...
probably like...
4 to 6 a.m.
Okay, so here's my thing from the public's point of view. Will that be flashed on your informational system board?
We are planning and don't have a plan to present today, but one of the focuses this year is to strengthen our communications plan with our customers around a campaign of courtesy and safety, and I think your comment is one that we certainly will include in considering the full message that we're going to be communicating to the customers
comment,
and what tools we'll use.
In the last comment, if you're going to do that, would you start at a reasonable time to get the mental mindset of the patron available to that time frame? Heightened, blah, blah, blah. Going to be such and such and so and so. But you need to start at least 3 to 4 weeks in advance or 3 to 5 weeks out. So you're right on it. November 15th is coming up.
So
you need
the
to start
relations
it
department.
Now.
Okay.
Yeah. So you guys are working on some other things too, based on what I know, right? Yeah. A campaign.
Why don't we go with Paul?
Going to swing around so I can face both the board and the audience. Just real quickly, our New Year's Eve service plan is to operate the normal evening service that BART runs now. Instead of a train every 15 minutes, it's a train every 20 minutes. We operate 3 of our 5 routes, the yellow line from Pittsburgh Bay Point to San Francisco, the orange line from Fremont to Richmond, and the blue line from Dublin to Daly City. We supplement that service with what we call event trains. New Year's Eve is very peaky, and the 20-minute service is sufficient except for the hour before the fireworks start, when there's a lot of folks coming downtown to see the fireworks, which start, as you know, right at midnight. And then the real challenge, both for the police department and for operations, is dealing with the huge crowds that we know you know, almost precisely what time they're going to hit us. It's at 12:25, which is when the fireworks end. So the advantage of using event trains rather than trying to schedule a train every 10 minutes instead of every 20 minutes is that event trains give us the flexibility to really have as many, a surge downtown, if you will, of trains right at the correct time. Last year we operated 7 event trains. Quite frankly, as you see the third bullet here, you know, we will operate as many event trains as there are train operators available. And I would just caution the board not to be the bearer of bad news, but we have had significant issues in the past with train operator availability on New Year's Eve. And it got to the point some years ago where the service was really inadequate to carry the number of people that were trying to leave downtown after the fireworks ended. Our response, it was so bad that our response to that was in the next negotiations to make New Year's Eve Day an ATU holiday. And that was an attempt to induce more operators to work that evening so that we in turn could provide sufficient event trains. So it's a challenge every year. We're going to work with the union. We're going to do everything we can to have sufficient number of train operators available. But at the end of the day, if they're not available, the trains don't run. If the trains don't run, it just takes us longer to get folks out of downtown, and it creates, quite frankly, a more tense situation downtown because of the crowding that we do experience. So the name of the game is to get as many train operators this year to sign up to work those event trains, and we'll be working on that between now and the end of the year. The second page talks about crowd management measures, and this is just from a civilian standpoint. I'm speaking for operations here. Our goal is to prevent platform overcrowding. Because if you can prevent platform overcrowding, that means you're really preventing train overcrowding as well. And, you know, the first strategy, obviously, is to provide enough service so that you can get people out of there quickly. We talked about that already. A change that we plan to implement this year is to not offer the flash passes, because, quite frankly, what the flash passes do is they contribute to the overcrowding that we experience in the system. When you have a crowd of the size that is in downtown San Francisco after the fireworks and trying to access the system, you're going to have overcrowding no matter what you do. The issue is, where do you want to have that overcrowding? And I think the last place that we want to have it is on the platform and on the train. So we're going to implement some additional strategies to try to move the crowding upstairs, at least to the concourse level, and quite frankly, a little bit up to the street level. And one of the strategies to do that is to eliminate the flash passes, because they just allow people to get into the system quicker. And quite frankly, they lead to some other problems as well, in terms of people having to stand at every swing gate and manage who has a flash pass and who thinks they can just flash their blue ticket and get in. The other strategy, and this is really a tactic that will be employed based on coordination between the police and operations, is, you know, quite frankly, it works to close the entrances at Embarcadero, or at least some of the entrances, because what that does is it funnels the crowd. It sort of de-intensifies the crowd a little bit. If a lot of people have to walk to Montgomery, that means they get spread out a little bit. Some of them even get a chance to sober up a little bit on the way to Montgomery. I'm not saying we're going to close Embarcadero completely. That's a call that's going to be made on the spot based on the conditions. But I will tell you, in the past, that we have closed entrances to Embarcadero in order to gain that thinning out of the crowd. Obviously, we're going to maximize our staffing in terms of not only train operators, but station agents and the supervisory staff as well. And then, you know, having our vertical circulation systems in good order, our elevators and escalators, our fare collection systems in good order with extra maintenance personnel out there is important in terms of not unduly delaying people. And then just lastly, just for your information, we've shown you the, these are the system-wide entries on New Year's Eve starting at midnight. So the way you read these numbers is that you see at 000, that's midnight, you see 3,723. That means 3,723 people entered the system between midnight and 12:30. So this shows you very clearly the peaking that we're talking about that occurs beginning at 12:25 when the fireworks end. Because between 12:30 and 1 o'clock, we had 10,300 people enter the system last year. And I just ran some numbers, and you know, these are system-wide numbers. The Embarcadero's share of this is well over half of this number. So, you know, the loading that we experience at Embarcadero after the fireworks is actually greater than what we experience during a normal 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. rush hour, and it's greater than what we experienced on Thursday in the maximum 1 hour when we broke our all-time ridership record. So there's a lot of people trying to get on BART in a relatively short period of time, and it presents a real challenge for us. Again, the key for us is going to be to have trains available to move people out of there.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay. Yes.
From the public standpoint again, if you're going to close Embarcadero, again, information to the public, so that if I experience going to the fireworks and I came in on Embarcadero, I go back down to Embarcadero and it's closed, there's no information for that. I can understand the operations point of view, but from a patron's point of view, you have to let me know that I cannot take Embarcadero unless I take whatever street that feeds into the 3,000 that you mentioned. So you have to, I'm sure Mr. Lee's gonna work that out through publicity, right? Because there's no way that I would know that I can't take Embarcadero without that thing flashing and saying, Embarcadero Station, blah, 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 is closed, please forward to such and such. That gives me ownership in the fact that I know BART is not just leaving me stranded, and where do I go from here? So if information, just from the patron's point of view. The other question I have is that from a patron's standpoint of view, if I bought my ticket in Oakland and I have to go to another station, what revenue loss did you factor into that?
The fares are the same.
From Embarcadero to
Montgomery.
To Montgomery, they're all the same.
All the downtown stations.
Oh, okay. Just, I mean, but if I didn't know that, the public would be, without thinking, well, where's my ticket and what can I do? As far as the fast pass, I don't know about that. But the main thing I want to emphasize is that if you have police presence, we have mentioned something about coffee or whatever, because we have to do something. You're going to limit the ridership from 3,000. That's 7,000 people that can't get into the Embarcadero and don't know where to go. And if they do get to another station, there's nobody there to greet them. So are you going to be compensating for that? Because we had mentioned coffee and whatever. You know, letting the people know this is maximum train. In next 20 minutes, you're going to have another station, and your 3,000 is going to do that. I'm trying to figure out how can we avert hostility among the patrons, because if I'm first, I don't want to be cut off. That's all I'm saying. I don't want to be saying you got to go to somebody
else.
No.
It's good to hear the various the viewpoints, because sometimes we forget. Because immediately one of the thoughts that came to my mind was not so much the flash pass as maybe some handouts just saying certain stations are closed.
Again, we aren't proposing to close
okay.
a station for
uh-huh.
its entirety. This is it's a tactic we use from time to time with large events of closing an entrance. I believe, Paul, there's usually someone there at that entrance
right.
that would then be directing customers to, here are your options. But it's not a permanent closure. It is response to crowding and
to
managing
slow it down
the crowding.
A little bit.
No, I mean that particular night. I know what you're saying.
No, I'm saying on that particular night. We might close for half an hour and then reopen.
So what you're saying to the public is you're rotating the time.
It's a crowd control.
Patron control. Patron control time. You're rotating the hour. If I leave at 12:25, and 20 minutes it'll open up, so I can stand there.
Well, the reason that it's even feasible to talk about this as a strategy is because the next station or the next entrance is a matter of a block or two or three away. I mean, that's the advantage, and that's what allows us to respond to overcrowding in a station in San Francisco, is the fact that if we do have to close a station for safety reasons because it is overcrowded, we can send people to the next station. For example, in Barcadero, the closest station is Montgomery. Well, the two entrances, the southernmost entrance to Embarcadero and the northernmost entrance to Montgomery, are within a couple hundred feet of each other. So it's not a huge inconvenience for people, especially because we will have folks at street level that are telling folks that this entrance is closed. Just keep walking down Market Street. You're already on Market Street. You've already been standing for half an hour to see the fireworks. Just walk another 5 minutes and you'll get to another station.
Information. We have to have information for the patrons. Like I say, I'm one of them. But the main thing I really want to emphasize is that the whole world is going to be out. The media is going to be out. The whole system is going to be all over YouTube again. So I was wondering how does the media play itself to the patrons? How are we going to work with that?
And let me use that segue to just wrap up with a few comments. In addition to showing the peaky nature of our demand on New Year's Eve, I think one of the things that the numbers Paul presented also raises is at least in every other year discussion, if not an annual discussion, about the hours of service for New Year's Eve and how much extra service do we, how much longer do we stay open. We are not proposing a change in the hours of service this year. We're proposing to continue to operate with the last dispatch at 3 a.m. But this is a question that I think we will continue to evaluate and revisit how we best serve our customers, best deploy our resources. And you can see we start to trend off later and the crowd naturally diminishes. And so no change recommended this year, but it is a question that we try to evaluate on a year-by-year basis. I did want to just wrap up with a few comments about communications and a particular issue that this committee has talked about at a prior meeting. We are going to be working through our communications group to have a more robust plan of communications with our customers, informing them of the service, engaging them in joining with us in providing courteous and a safe experience for everybody on the system. It's a night of revelry, but hopefully we can encourage responsible revelry and help ensure a good environment for all of the people using the BART system. We are also working in discussions with the City of Oakland to explore whether there are any community-based event or celebration that we can participate in that creates a forum, a positive forum for folks in Oakland to participate in. We are planning to be in communication with the Johnson Grant family to talk with them about any anniversary commemoration or memorialization activities and how, if we can be engaged or supportive of that. You may recall we worked with families immediately after the shooting this year to make available space at the Fruitvale station for expressions of sympathy or condolence to be made by the public. We have not had that discussion yet, so I don't have much to tell you about what their thinking is, but to be in communication there. And finally, We had discussed, at least at our last committee meeting, the idea of serving coffee at some of the BART stations. It's something we have done from time to time in the past, way back in the 80s. I think it was a community partnership where we provided the coffee, and I believe with the Gray Panthers and B'nai B'rith congregation members served the coffee. Frankly, their experience was so unpleasant that they declined to continue. And then we have, many, many years ago, I think, not since the mid-90s, provided coffee in some of our stations. It's a tough night to be serving coffee. And I just want to, I think we're all, certainly have heard the board's interest, or expressed by some board members, in wanting to find a way to be visible and welcoming and positive interaction with our customers. And we've been thinking about ways to do that. I did feel that we needed to tell you our past experience with coffee ended up with some unpleasant experiences with coffee being thrown on people. It creates another dynamic potentially in the station. Some other ideas that we have been exploring. I don't have anything to say we can do yet, but we've had some success partnering with coffee companies to offer coupons for coffee, that you can get the coupon in the station but go get the coffee somewhere else. Partnering with chocolate manufacturers to distribute chocolates in the system. But is there something that doesn't create as much potential negative interaction as a hot cup of coffee might, is one of the thoughts we wanted to bring forward.
Could I raise an issue? I think that that evening, rather than, you know, trying to have somebody at all the stations, you know, that's asking a bit much, but is there a thought, and I'm just throwing this out, at least at the Fruitvale station, and right across from the entryway there is a coffee shop there. And my thought would be that there's a possibility either that coffee shop we request, you know, if they would consider being open, and we do a coupon thing there if someone's interested in it, or the other possibility is just have bottles of water instead. They could throw that, okay, yeah. But anyway, it's just not, it was some ideas for, well, maybe it's bottled water or coffee at the coffee shop, which is across the way. That's a possibility. But anyway, I just think maybe at that one station would be a much easier one, and that is symbolic of the station where the incident occurred, rather than trying to get it at all of them. But
or at any station, if again, I don't want to speak for the entire board. Certainly a couple of the board members were pretty vocal at our last meeting about their personal interest in engaging this. Any station in a board member's district where the board member wanted to participate, that we could support that activity. And it's clearly our three busiest, two busiest stations, as Paul's numbers have shown, are Embarcadero and Montgomery. Beyond that, we start to, you know, reflect the normal origins and destinations of the system. But the event attraction is Embarcadero and Montgomery. And obviously, Carol, your comments about the Fruitvale station. Just wanted to put that idea back on the table for board member reaction or thoughts.
Tom's trying to.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was glad to hear the reports from both the police and operations about, you know, what all you're doing to make this a successful event. And, you know, I want to have a successful New Year's this year. No one's going to be happier that 2009 is over than myself and I'm planning a party. It will be the anniversary of Oscar Grant's death, and I like the idea that we are talking to the family, we should talk to the faith community in Oakland, and just say, okay, what's the appropriate way to remember this? And, you know, if they want to work with BART, great. If they don't, that's great, too. But I like the idea of reaching out. Whatever we can do to kind of make it user-friendly to folks who don't use the system typically, I was thinking, like, you know, on every ticket machine, you just say, round trip from Embarcadero, $4.10 from this station in big letters. So folks who don't use it seldom have the round trip in their pocket, and they're not trying to figure out how to get a ticket at the Embarcadero or at Montgomery. than I'd have, so some of that communication we could probably work with. I like the idea of working with the vendors that we already have. We have a lot more in our stations than we did in the 80s, so we could just say to you know, the Pete's Coffee kiosks and the others, mm-hmm. just say, hey, you know, if you want to stay open late, we encourage you to do that. Folks can maybe get a little something to eat, get a cup of coffee or something else, juice, whatever it is that they want, before they get on the train. So that'll help spread out the loads, kind of chill people out a little bit. If community groups want to do it, great. I'd love to talk to merchants associations. You know, there's a lot of neighborhoods, you know, like I think about the Mission, I think about the Castro, the Haight, Soma, where there's a lot of clubs, a lot of bars. Talking to those folks early, saying, you know, we know all your patrons are going to be out on the street at this time. Think about if you want to do something, let's say on the plaza at 16th and Mission, you know, so you want to have, you know, you want to serve coffee and donuts, let them do it. I know if you go around my neighborhood late at night, there's always the carts with the bacon-wrapped hot dogs. And I'm not saying we serve bacon-wrapped hot dogs, but there are the folks who sell that stuff, and it's actually sometimes nice, whatever it is. But it's nice to be able to, okay, you've been out, you know, mm-hmm. get something to eat, you know, hang out for a little bit, then get on the train. So
I'll speak to you.
Yeah, and kind of encourage the, I would say, you know, merchants, vendors, and the neighborhood associations and the associations of bar owners and stuff to work with it. I'd also say let's talk to the Entertainment Commission in San Francisco. You know, it's a big night. There is an Entertainment Commission. They have staff. They have the connections with the bar and the club owners. Work with them and say, hey, these are the problems we often encounter. We want to work with the bar and the club owners in San Francisco and with the Entertainment Commission to take the edge off of that. How can we make this a better experience for people going out that night and see if they have any ideas or they want to help out or even have funding for some stuff we want to do. But
That evening, I'll be in bed, but I'll be
you'll
really...
Be in bed. But you'll be very happy.
I'll be very happy to help any groups that want to give coffee or something.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think there's a way to make this really successful, and it just involves working with a lot of people that we typically don't work with. They're all happy to have us open later, but I think we need to go back to those folks and say, we want to serve your customers,
your
but
help.
They cause problems for us. Help us figure this out. Yeah.
Jesse?
I was just... the flash passes, table ticket sales, we actually sell them the bar tickets. We've done that in the past. We can sell them the round trip bar tickets.
Oh, that's an idea.
Good idea.
Very good, Jesse. Yeah, I'm impressed.
No, I'm smart. Promote.
The truth comes out.
Hey, I got you. And that goes to show you when you get those unions together.
Yes. Well, as you know, we don't get to make those decisions.
Yeah,
table
ticket sales
would be great. We did that for years.
Table ticket sales, that's a great idea.
Yeah, that's an idea. Okay. All right. Well, are there any other questions? Any answers? Okay. With all that, our next meeting possibility? If we have to get back, well, we don't have to set the date now, but if we wanted to come back together in a couple of weeks so we can move this in. Can you? You're okay over there? All right. Okay.
I don't know what I'm okay with. But I clearly am okay with it.
Really focusing on the selection criteria?
Yes.
And more New Year's Eve.
Exactly. Okay. And then also kind of like to see what media, you know, some of your ideas or what you guys have planned.
When is the recruiting actually going to open?
Okay. Then let me give you a timeline. Rather than.
Would you like me to poll the members for the next meeting?
Yes, please. Oh, there she is.
A voice.
I heard a voice, a blast from the
pastor. Where's the body?
Yes.
The voice.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and thank you for the community input. Very, very appreciative. Don't call us for the market.